Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, and it's the first Wednesday of the month, and actually the first day of the month. And when it's the first Wednesday of the month, we always talk about wildlife issues and natural resource issues. And usually Scott Craven's around to do that. And he's back today with us by phone from Kemp Station, I believe. Hey, Scott.
Hey, Larry. How's it going?
It's going pretty well, and you're at the Kemp Station today, aren't you?
I am at the Kemp Natural Resources Station. It is just a glorious day here in the North Woods. It's cool. In fact, I guess you could describe it as cold this morning, but for July weather in the North Woods and a beautiful 4th of July weekend coming up, this is pretty sweet.
Yeah, I envy you. I envy you that place you're in right now. It's a beautiful, beautiful place.
Well, it's kind of interesting. Today is the day that I'm anxious to go down and look at the lake here, Lake Tomahawk, and see if anybody's motor trolling, because there's certainly been a big fuss about the fact that that goes into play today for the first time ever here on these Northwood lakes. So we'll see how that plays out.
Yeah, and so motor trolling for muskie?
Well, for anything, yeah. For anything, basically. Yeah. Although on these lakes, on some of the musky waters, they were able to keep that to one line, one hook and line per person, or two per boat. So it's not basically three lines and as many people are in the boat as are in the boat times three as it is in most of the rest of the state and has been for a while. So
yeah.
We'll see.
We'll see how it goes. In terms of wildlife, what are you seeing out there? What's on your mind news-wise in terms of the wildlife here in Wisconsin?
Well, it's the time of year when most of the spring surveys are coming out. The results are coming out, and people look forward to, particularly for the game species, what that portends for the fall. So we'll talk a little bit about that, the waterfowl surveys, the grouse surveys, and that kind of thing. So those are available. The wolf meeting that a lot of people have been waiting for was held recently, that released information on what the winter wolf estimate was after that perhaps final wolf hunt last fall. So we can talk about that a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of at the tail end of the baby animal season, but there's a big and very active and well-done DNR and partner initiative on keeping wildlife wild and keeping baby animals in the wild and that kind of thing. So that's kind of winding down for the season. But people's gardens are becoming productive. I know mine sure is.
Yeah, mine too.
People often get a little uptight about ground squirrels, rabbits, moles, birds, deer, and assorted other things. And then hopefully you and I will have a chat about, I was just up in Door County last week, and the new nature center.
Oh, the Cook Albert Fuller Center.
Yes, it's a beautiful facility. I got the behind-the-scenes tour of that. I want to talk a little bit about that. And then, you know, as I talk to you, we're going to talk a little bit about something we've never really done before, which is talk a bit about taxidermy and maybe let the listeners get more involved than they thought they might in the program today. So we'll see how that all plays out.
Got lots that we can talk about. You mentioned fawn, and I think Ken in Reedsburg has a question relating to fawns. Hi, Ken. Thank you for calling.
Hi there. I get out and about a lot in the spring for turkey hunting and mushroom picking and stuff, and I usually see some spotted fawns, and this year I haven't seen any, and I'm just wondering if that's a coincidence or if there's some problem that he knows about.
Well, Ken, I think the most likely explanation is coincidence. I've seen a few fawns myself, but not many, but the there are a couple of things potentially going on. One is we've had plenty of rain recently, and the vegetation is just thick, and a fawn is pretty easy to hide. Maybe 3 days ago, my house looks out over our 10-acre restored prairie, and I saw a doe coming across the neighbor's alfalfa field, which had been just cut. So there was a young fawn with her, right behind her. And the doe got into my prairie grass, and as she moved through the grass, all you could see were the tips of her ears emerging above the grass, and the fawn was invisible. I mean, I wouldn't have known if she had 10 fawns with her. So I think vegetation is the big concealment issue, which may have some bearing on it. But also, depending on where you are, it's very hard to know what the deer population is anymore. As you know, because of all the changes in deer management brought about by the Deer Trustee Report a couple of years ago, the DNR is no longer talking much about numbers, you know, how many deer per square mile or what the population estimate is or anything else. All you really hear is the new county committees coming to a conclusion that, oh, there's enough deer or not enough deer, or, okay, we're going to try and keep it where it is. So it's very difficult to say in any given area whether the herd is up, down, or the same. So there may be fewer deer, there may not be, but I think the vegetation and the way the weather's been going is probably the big factor.
Oh, there we go. Thanks a lot.
Along with luck of the draw.
Yeah, luck of the draw. Dean in Fort Atkinson, it's your turn. Hi, Dean.
Hi. Hey, got a little story for you. The other day at work, I saw red-tailed hawk flying around in the little... And the blackbirds and stuff, like, fly around them. Are you there?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I thought you were breaking up. That's all right.
Yeah,
go ahead.
They keep flying around him and pestering the black-tailed hawk or the red-tailed hawk while he's flying around. And the other day, I actually saw two blackbirds land on the red-tailed hawk while he was flying. They would, like, land on him, ride him for a couple seconds, get off. The next guy would take a ride. I've never seen anything like that before.
Well, that's a sight. Hey, have you ever seen that, Scott?
I have not, but one of my colleagues, maybe 5 or 10 years ago, it's quite common for various small birds to mob or attack a raptor like a red-tailed hawk, and we see it all the time around the house, and my wife always says, well, why doesn't that hawk just roll over and grab those little pests? And they don't, for whatever reason. They just put up with it and then head into cover. But I had heard that people had observed things like red-winged blackbirds or whatever actually grabbing onto or hanging onto or riding on the hawk for a period. I said, boy, that's hard to believe. And then one of my colleagues came in and had a very well-documented account of it. So it does happen. Usually they'll just kind of buzz down and maybe take a swipe at it or get close to it and harass it the way they will a human if they're around their nesting site. But they will, in fact, apparently ride on the back. So Dean's sighting was a really cool one. I've not seen it myself, but it does happen. And I'll tell you what, that strikes me as being a pretty bold red-winged blackbird to jump onto the back of a bird that's about 20 times as big as it is and has very big talons.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Speaking of attacking, you've got to go to my Facebook page, our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. Marilyn posted a photo of a bobcat, and she says, Sunday morning I looked out our front window to see a once-in-a-lifetime sight, a bobcat who was trying to catch the squirrels that feed on our bird feeders.
Hmm.
It was amazing to watch it hunt as it slowly approached our fir tree. And she's got a photo of the bobcat right next to the bird feeders.
Wow, that's pretty cool, too. I mean, they're very stealthy and quiet, just like a house cat is when it's stalking something around the yard. Did she happen to say if it was successful?
She didn't say if it was successful.
A bird feeder, that's just one of many reasons why having a bird feeder is a cool thing to do. Yes, you feed the birds, but in some cases you have to take the perspective that you're also then providing squirrels, birds, chipmunks, or whatever for some predators that may visit the feeder. And, you know, I think the most interesting accounts we've had on the show over the years, not cats as much as you recall a couple of occasions where people had great blue herons.
Yes.
Coming up out of a lake or marsh or whatever and standing stock still next to their feeders and snatching chipmunks or ground squirrels.
Yeah.
And taking them back to the water. I mean, that's pretty cool, too. So whether it's a great blue heron or a raptor like a Cooper's hawk or a cat like a bobcat, a bird feeder is a source of food for them, and they take advantage of it. Pretty cool.
Really cool photo. And Marilyn, thanks a lot for posting it on our Facebook page. Something else posted on our Facebook page, I think Cheyenne's got it up now, is something a colleague mentioned to me, and I went to look at it, and it's amazing. It's a live feed on Brooks Falls in the Katmai National Park in Alaska. And the Brooks Falls are about a 6-foot drop, and the salmon are coming up it right now. And this is a live video feed of grizzlies and other bears feeding on the salmon, catching them live.
Well, that's a pretty neat one. I've not seen that one myself. I was doing a talk at Wild Birds Unlimited last Saturday, and they had a number of different live feeds coming into the store of nesting eagles and bird feeders and things like that. So if somebody's diligent on the internet, I think you can find a live feed these days to show you just about anything. But watching the bears would be pretty cool.
Oh, there were three. When I was watching, there were three bears feeding in the right by the falls, or either one was on top of the falls and two were sort of on the bottom, just feeding on those that didn't quite make it up the top. So it was it's pretty cool. And we do have a link on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show if you want to take a look at that. It's really pretty cool. I wanted to go to Pat next, because Pat also has a question on fawns, or a comment on fawns, at least. Pat and Rudolph, thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you. My husband was near our vegetable garden, which is a very grassy area on a path to our pond, day before yesterday, and he saw three fawns with spots. Mm. He did not see the mother, but there is tall grass. And one of them, they were about 10 feet away from him. One took a step toward him. They didn't see the mom, but he was very happy.
Oh, yeah. But mom was sure to be close. I would bet on that, Scott.
Yep. I'm sure she was around somewhere, but that's a neat sighting. Yeah, it's always fun to see a fawn. They're cute little things, and people get great pictures of them. And seeing three triplets is on the high end. Twins are more common, but triplets and sometimes even quads are not unheard of. So that was a neat thing all the way around.
Oh, thanks, Pat. Appreciate it. Jerry in Grafton, your turn. Hi, Jer.
Hi, guys. Over the last week, we were up in Marinette County, and we saw for a good length of time a brown-faced black bear cub. How unusual is that?
Trying to think.
Well, it's unusual, but it does happen. Most mammals, bears more so than many, not as common as squirrels, but there are a number of animals, mammals, that will have different color phases even within the same litter. So I don't really know how to characterize it. It does happen. It's known to happen, but it's certainly not common. The vast majority of the cubs are normal black coloration. Depending on where you go in the country, brown phases, bluish black phases in the Pacific Northwest, there are variations across the country, just like here in Wisconsin. A black-gray squirrel is much more common up here where I am today in the Northwoods than it is in southern Wisconsin. So there's a bit of regional variation, but it does happen, and it's a cool thing to see, but I couldn't attach a percentage to you. Maybe there's somebody out there listening who works with bears or has access to the internet and can come up with a proportion, but I'm sure it's very small.
Yeah.
So you saw an unusual thing, which makes a wildlife sighting even more fun than it would be otherwise.
Well, yeah.
And its mother was black.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They were together. It was about a year and a half old cub.
Ah.
Okay. Well. And still brown. Okay. Would they change color at all, Scott, over time or not?
It depends on the animal. I think if it's already a year and a half old, it's likely to remain brownish throughout life. But you recall a few years ago all the hoopla over the white buffalo that was born down in Janesville, and then over time that white coloration faded, and I think by the time it was a couple of years old, it looked like a normal bison. So
yep.
But it seems to me that that's, with the bear, that's likely to persist like it does in a gray squirrel.
Thanks, Jerry, for calling. Appreciate it. Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Cheyenne Lentz, our on-air producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network as we look at the world of wildlife with wildlife specialist Scott Craven. I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you so much for joining us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up at 2 o'clock, just to let you know, the Milwaukee Art Museum is currently hosting the Van Gogh Pollock Modern Rebels exhibit, and Kathleen Dunn and her guests are going to talk about that exhibit. Features more than 70 masterpieces from artists of the 20th century. That's at 2 right now. Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist.
Say, Larry, that last break for commercial break was pretty interesting because last week they were just advertising Al Johnson's up in Door County, and I was up there doing a talk and had lingonberries and Swedish meatballs at Al Johnson's. So I know you know that place very well, and it was fun.
I was just thinking about that myself, and I thought, I've got to get back up to Door County. Haven't been there yet this summer, and so I'm missing that. And by the way, Marilyn, who took the photo of the bobcat, said the bobcat was not successful. She just Facebooked back to me a message. And that, and she has some more photos as well she posted. So there are quite a few photos on our Facebook page if you want to take a look and see the bobcat hunting around a bird feeder. We have lots of callers here online, but I want to go back to as long as we're talking about Door County, I want to see that new nature center, the Cook Albert Fuller Center. Where is it located, Scott, and what? Tell us about it.
Well, I got the tour. Just the grand opening was just a couple weeks ago, and the formal name is the Cook Albert Fuller Center, but I think people will come to know it primarily as the Ridges Nature Center. It is the public face of the Ridges Sanctuary, which has been in Bailey's Harbor for many years. The Nature Center, or the Cook Albert Fuller Center, is right in essentially, well, Bailey's Harbor is not a big place, but if you're coming north on the main drag through Bailey's Harbor and head just past the harbor where the public boat launch is, it's just up there another 100 yards or so past the town hall on the site of the old Sandpiper restaurant that people may remember, where there was an excellent fish boil for many years.
Yep.
So they bought that site, built the nature center, and that's where it's located, right on the main road. You can't miss it. It's a beautiful building. It was all, as you might expect, built with an eye toward sustainability and ecological principles and so forth. The parking lot, for example, is a very interesting plastic grid of little compartments, about each one about the size of a normal brick, and then they're filled with pea gravel, and then that goes down to larger gravel and eventually down to rock, and it's completely porous, so there's no runoff whatsoever from that parking lot surface, unlike a normal paved surface.
That's pretty cool.
There are some neat features like that. Their permanent exhibits will go in place next year, but right now it is filled with stuff, including many hands-on activities for kids to do, to explore plants and wildlife and all the ecological ins and outs of Door County, which are interesting in and of themselves. It's open 9 to 6, 7 days a week. There are guided hikes every day at 9:30 and 1:30, and there are folks around to field questions for visitors. There are some new trails that leave from the Nature Center and head off into the Ridges property, where you can see that famous ridge and swale situation that gave the Ridges its name and all their rare plants, including a new trail called the Family Discovery Trail, which is also open. And that's particularly cool because there are lots of things on the trail for kids to do and see, like build a bridge across a creek and things they can touch and dig through and play with and assorted other things. So
that's very cool.
It's a cool site. And I don't want to short, there are many really nice nature centers around Wisconsin. And I think the message here, yes, this is a new one. It's really nice if you're in Door County, a great thing to do with the kids or for anybody. And excellent bird watching and botanizing. But if you don't happen to be in Door County, there's a good, a really top-notch nature center in virtually every corner of the state. So check them out, and it's something to do on a, especially if, you know, on a family vacation, rainy afternoon or whatever, there's an option for you.
Mary in Hurdle has a question for you, Scott. Let's go there. Hi, Mary. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I'm just calling about the hounders in my area. We have, I live in the northwestern part of the state, and we had hounders, packs of half a dozen, that would drive up and down the road, and when the dogs would sound off, they stop and let them out, whether it's private property or whatever. I raise French bulldogs, and I have a fenced-in yard, 6-foot-high cyclone, and these dogs run through my property, my neighbor's property, and after wolves or bear. And it's really becoming a problem.
What do you, Scott, what do you do in a situation like this? I mean,
well,
you've got...
it's a very difficult one, Larry. I've heard it many times before. You know, most houndsmen are try to be respectful of private property and, you know, and try and know where they are on the landscape. If there's someone who's particularly upset by this, you know, I think most people would try and avoid that. The problem, of course, is the animal being pursued, usually a bear, not a wolf, now that the wolf season has been effectively terminated by the court rulings giving wolves federal protection again. But there are also, you know, dogs hunting coons and some other species. So it does happen. And, of course, the problem is the animal being pursued, let's say a bear, for example, the bear neither knows nor cares whether it's on Joe's property, a county forest, a national forest, or whatever. The bear is going to go where it wants to go to avoid or try and avoid pursuit. And, of course, the hounds are going to follow, again, regardless of property boundaries. And that does clearly pose some source of friction between the hunters and private property owners who just don't want that activity to take place on their property or find it disruptive or potentially hazardous to their own livestock, pets, or whatever. Now, having explained all that, what to do about it is very difficult because it's unpredictable. And I think this becomes, it becomes a matter of trespass. So that's a legal issue on the one hand, but it's also something of an educational issue on the other hand. So if I were, well, I am on my property in Price County. I'm in an area where bear hunting is quite commonplace. And if I were concerned about that, I don't think it's difficult to find out who the local hunters are, or work through the Wisconsin Bear Hunters Association, which is a very active and pretty responsive group. You know, they assist with research projects, and they know what's going on. They know who their people are and where they are, and attempt to make it known to them, or make it known to folks that you know in the area have hounds, that, hey, come on, folks, we just don't want you on our property.
In this case, it sounded, too, like they were just letting the dogs loose right on private property. So that's
right. And, of course, the problem is, you know, that happens. The hounds take off. They take off in pursuit of the hounds, and they may only be on a given ownership for a matter of 3 minutes, and, boom, they're gone onto somebody else's property. So actually finding them, if you were to treat it as trespass and call the sheriff's office, for them to actually find the people involved is not an easy proposition. And I realize for most people it would be pretty intimidating to, if you see the cars, and sometimes with a bear hunting group, I've seen groups of, you know, a dozen vehicles in the caravan, to go out and confront them or try and get license plate numbers or whatever would not be something the average person really wants to do. So that's
I like your idea about going through the Wisconsin, the Bear Hunters Association to kind of find out.
Well, I mean, that would be, I think, a starting point because they communicate with their members. But I'm sure the bear hunters are all aware of this and or any other type of hunters. And as with any group of people, whether it's bear hunters, deer hunters, golfers, plumbers, you pick the group, you pick the demographic, there are always going to be, I think, the majority of the people in any group that are try to be responsible. And there are usually a few on the fringe who are pushing the envelope a little bit or maybe don't care where their dogs run. How to police that or do anything about it is a very difficult thing to do. So yeah. I would start with the associations, talk to the neighbors, talk to the sheriff's department, do whatever posting you need to do on your property, but realize that those dogs could have been released 2 miles away on a county forest where everything was completely cricket and the animal being pursued leads them right through your backyard. There's really little or nothing that even the responsible houndsman can do under that circumstance.
Mary, thank you for calling. Appreciate your call. We had an email from Marcy in Waterloo, just a totally different topic. Just kind of cool topic. This, she says, this morning when I opened the garage door to leave for work, there was a fox in the driveway. The neighbor's cat was a few yards from the fox and every few minutes would chase the fox around the yard. Does this seem to be normal behavior for these two animals?
Well, I guess the short answer is no, but the corollary to that is normal is a rather difficult term to apply for urban-suburban wildlife interactions because some of these animals, particularly fox, become pretty habituated to living in a human-dominated landscape and get used to the notion that there are pets around, and unless they view the cat as a prey animal, which a coyote certainly would, the fox may put up with that, at least for a while. One never knows what the ultimate outcome is. To me, that seems like a pretty bold house cat pursuing an animal that is probably twice or more its size, and cats aren't necessarily protective of their home turf as a dog might be. So that does seem a little bizarre to me, but I'm not surprised at all that it happened.
I was somebody sent me a YouTube of a cat, an alligator coming up on a lawn, and the cat actually attacked the alligator and chased it off the lawn and back into the water.
Well, that may have happened in that case, but in most cases with such an encounter, I would guess that the alligator just ends up with lunch, and that's the end of the story.
Facebook comment from Rich in New York. I saw a young whitetail buck with antlers about the size of my hand. They were in velvet. And this is the season for that, I guess.
It is the season. Antlers are growing again, and they'll continue to grow into early fall and the early part of the archery season when hunters do take bucks that are still in velvet. But by the time, you know, mid-fall, into September, early October rolls around, most of that velvet's been fallen off, dried off, or scraped off by the bucks doing the rubbing that everybody comes to recognize. And then they have their polished antlers for the rut and the gun hunting season, and the antlers fall off again next winter, and the whole process starts all over again.
Starts all over. We had a Facebook comment from Marsha. I was checking emails this morning when a doe and a spotted fawn walked right by my window. Our place is between Herbster and Cornucopia in Bayfield County on Bark Point, so they're out there running around. And we had a Facebook question from Ken in Little Chute. Yesterday, as I was about to start my early morning run through a wooded park, I saw a gray fox. He barked at me a few times, watched me watching him for a minute, and then headed down the path I wanted to take. I took another route. Would I have to worry about an attack if I went down his path? How rare is a gray fox?
Well, they're less common to see than a red fox, but they're around. They're more prone to be in wooded areas than red fox that like a little more open countryside. Beautiful animal. I don't think there's any particular risk of an attack, but there may have been pups around and the animal was just being protective. But I don't think that's a great deal to that's much to worry about, but certainly another interesting observation. And just for a sec, back on that subject of the velvet, if anybody's got a buck hanging around their property and can watch those antlers develop, it really is an amazing process. I mean, that is solid, rock-hard bone that's eventually forming underneath that layer of velvet. The velvet itself is just highly vascularized, soft tissue that's kind of fuzzy in nature, with lots of blood taking nourishment to the growing bone. But it's amongst the most rapidly growing type of tissue there is, and you'll see those antlers progress from a little nubbin up to eventually maybe a great big 10 or 12 point rack over a very short period of time. And then once the growth terminates, that velvet dries off and sloughs away. But it nourishes that, in the case of a large buck, a pretty impressive structure of bone over a very short period of growth. So it's kind of neat to watch.
It definitely is. Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist, our guest here today on the Ideas Network. Question for him. I hope you'll join us. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can post on our Facebook page. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Post your question or comment there. Bill in Madison up next. Hi, Bill. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. I saw something quite strange. A robin flew into our picture window up at our cabin, and unfortunately, I believe it broke its neck because it flopped around for a while, and then it died. And a few minutes later, another robin came and laid on top of it, like it was mourning the death of its mate or something. And I didn't realize that birds acted like that.
Boy, that's
Well, it depends on the birds, but the pair bond can be pretty strong. What was actually going on there, we'll never know, but it could have been the mate of the bird. Just say, hey, what the heck's going on here? It happens regularly in birds that pair for an extended period. Just as an example, when I many years ago when I worked at Horicon Marsh with Canada geese, we used to pick up or catch as many birds as we could find that seemed to have lost flight. Some were essentially crippled during the hunting season or whatever else was wrong. We'd pick them up, and we had a big flight pen that we would keep them in and try and rehab them to the point that they could fly again, and we'd let them go. And it happened on multiple occasions that we would pick up a bird, take it back and put it in the pen, and all of a sudden, within a relatively short period of time, a perfectly healthy, free-flying wild bird would show up next to the pen and just hang around outside the pen, pacing back and forth, and occasionally stay there for an extended period until we released some birds, and then all of a sudden it would take off, and we would have apparently had and ultimately released its mate or family member, and they left together. By the same token, we'd catch hundreds of birds at a time in a net, and as we banded them and released them, most flew off, but again, on occasion, we'd let one go that had a nice fresh, shiny band on it, and it wouldn't go anywhere, run off to the side and stand there. And we'd release one bird, two birds, five birds, 10 birds, then all of a sudden apparently release the bird that it was waiting for, and they'd get together and fly off together. So it does happen in birds. Whether that was what you saw in that robin or not, we'll never know for sure, but it's certainly possible. And then the other thing, as far as them flying into the window, robins are notorious for attacking windows, usually not with enough vigor to injure or kill themselves, but they're very territorial, and they attack their reflection in a large window, and that also may have been what was going on there.
Yeah, that's good. Thank you, Bill, for calling. Connie in Portage, turn to you next. Hi, Connie.
Hi, good morning. I have a question. Our neighbors took two raccoons. They caught them and trapped them and took them about 12, 15 miles away. And I didn't want them to, but they were very destructive. So now I have four babies. running around, and I'm worried sick about them, so I'm feeding them cat food, and I'm wondering what I should feed them.
Well, Connie, you're probably not going to like my answer, but I don't think you should feed raccoons anything. When you say babies, how big are they?
Well, they're not very big. They're, mother must have still been nursing them, don't you think? I mean,
I don't know. I mean, without seeing them.
The size of a cat, or?
Well, depends on the cat. I'd say about, maybe 6 to 10 inches long, and about 6 to 8, 10 inches high.
I think that those animals are probably capable of taking care of themselves. And I don't want this to seem unduly harsh in terms of, cutting off support, but the longer you feed them, the only thing you're going to accomplish is to make them dependent on you or people in general, and they're going to become an even worse problem for you and your neighbors than the two adults were, and they're going to end up in the same fate or worse. So I think you're best off to not subsidize them at all, let them go about their business, and hopefully move away, or they'll just become, as I say, a worse problem around the property or around other people's property than the adults were.
Yeah.
Because they'll be even less fearful of humans.
Yeah, so good advice. Thank you, Connie, for calling. Appreciate your call very much. And we'll turn to Jackie in Milwaukee next. Hi, Jackie.
A friend of ours has a home where they've had a lot of turkeys around. And a few days ago, there were two male turkeys, what do you call them?
Gobblers.
That were fighting.
Mm-hmm.
And they were doing a job on her flower bed.
Oh.
And she decided to go out and confront them. And then a man driving by said, "No, no, don't do that. You could be hurt." And I've seen on television where a man raised a bunch of turkeys, and at the end the male got after him and really did hurt him. Is that something that we should be concerned about?
No, I don't think so. First of all, it's pretty late in the breeding season, very late in the breeding season, for the males to care very much about fighting over territorial issues or hen turkeys. So the fact that they were fighting at this point in the season seems to be, we're at the tail end of having to worry about that. And the turkeys were undoubtedly far more worried about each other than they may have been worried about human intervention. The turkey season just ended about 4 weeks ago. These birds should still be pretty nervous about humans around. And I don't think necessarily confronting them by running up to them and trying to shoo them away as if they were sparrows is necessarily the best idea. But a sharp noise, popping a paper bag, clapping your hands, banging some pots and pans together, and trying to look intimidating should have sent them packing in a hurry.
There we go. Thank you, Jackie.
If not that, turn on the garden hose and give them a good spraying. They wouldn't like that very much either. But I don't think being attacked is a very likely proposition. And, again, they are big and they're powerful, but they are birds. Their equipment is limited. They have spurs on their legs, which they can use, and their wings can give somebody a little beating if they're doing it, but not, it's not like you're facing a mountain lion.
Thanks again, Jackie, for calling. Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for listening in on the Ideas Network. Talking today with Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist, Larry Mueller here. Join in. We have one open line, I think, 1-800-642-1234. Again, if you've got a photo or a question that you want to post to our Facebook page, please go ahead and do that. Our Facebook page name is The Larry Mueller Show, so that's how you get to the page. Or you can email us a question at talk@wpr.org. Wallace in Rusk County up next. Hi, Wallace.
Hi. Larry, that's quite a show. I'm getting up in age, and I'm having an eye treatment, so I've been really listening to these programs for a while. Just to make a little difference on the light side of life,
yeah,
maybe a little laugh will do us all good. This is a story about a bear. Up here in Rust County, near Weyerhaeuser, it's like a bear encampment. We have no shortage. I see bear tracks in the gardens and everything, you know. And my bird feeder is not too far from the house. And one morning I get up and I'm looking at the bird feeder. What the heck happened? There's nothing but shreds. Uh-oh. I figured, a bear. Sure enough. So, okay, I repair it that day. And I thought to myself, son of a gun, you know, I hope you stay away. And I hung up. Gunny sack or something up there. I thought it might disappear. It smelled a little bit of diesel oil from the tractor. But next morning, the bird feeder's wrecked again. So, okay. So I put it together, and I go over to the farm that left, and I get an electric fencer. And I run the cord out there, and I put the wire on an insulator, and about 4 feet from the ground, on the end of the wire, I stabbed it into a piece of deteriorating piece of sausage, and I wrapped it on tight. And I was curious to see. Next morning, all the cords were stretched straight out as the wire, and the sausage was still on there with a huge hole poked in it. So the bear never come back.
Well, there's a story for you, Scott.
Well, that's a good one. I guess sometimes home remedy has some merit. If it worked for you, bears can be pretty persistent and sometimes destructive. But, you know, despite the fact that we tend to dwell on problems and things like that and people worried about their safety, on balance, I mean, most wildlife encounters are very positive, and people are happy to see these things, and they're fun to watch, and you occasionally get a laugh or a smile or a good photograph out of it. So all's well that ends well in that case.
Thanks, Wallace, for calling. Appreciate your call. We had a call. Scott in Watertown wondered, how long is a fawn dependent on its mother, and how long can a fawn survive if its mother dies early?
Well, that's a tough one. I mean, generally speaking, by the time early fall rolls around, into September, fawns can get by on their own.
So that's May to September, roughly.
Well, yeah, they're usually dropped latter part of May, early June. So into we're getting into July here. This is still a time where I would say the majority of them are dependent. So if the doe is hit by a car, taken by a predator, whatever, the fawn is probably going to perish eventually. Mm-hmm. Due to dehydration or starvation or what have you, and it certainly is going to be weakened and debilitated and therefore much more vulnerable to a predator anyway. But they do grow and develop and become highly mobile very quickly, so with every passing day, there's a better chance that they will survive, and generally by probably the first part of September, most would get along okay if something happened to mom.
And then they stay with mom.
Yeah, most of them will stay with mom anyway, well into the fall and winter, and then start to disperse next year when another round of fawns is coming on.
I think mom just kicks them out if they're still
exactly.
with her.
Yep.
And that's when we, I think, at least my own experiences, you see more deer, young deer, dead along the roadside about that time of the year, and I think it's because they don't know what they're doing.
Right. There are several events, the rut being the major one, but also that period of dispersal and kind of freedom of movement in early spring after a tough winter when road kills tend to spike.
Jim and Host Lake, thanks a lot for calling. It's your turn.
Hi. Well, real quickly on that last question, my Native American friends told me that you can shoot deer in any month that has an R in them. Okay.
I thought that applied to oysters, but maybe it works for deer, too.
Well, I would disagree with March, but it's probably fairly accurate. All right, really, I'll call about two things real quickly. One, fawns and probably all baby animals. The city people that come up here, leave them alone. They are not abandoned. Look at them, enjoy it, and walk away. They are not abandoned. Now, that's probably not 100% true, but...
99.9.
Yeah, and occasionally the ones that that are abandoned, and nobody likes to hear this, but the fact is all the animals have to eat.
Yeah.
And the coyotes and crows have to eat also. So you maybe don't want to think about that, but just leave them alone. Then finally, the wolf decision. I think it was yesterday. That's not good for the wolves. The boys up here, girls, you go into a coffee shop or tavern and listen, they're going to start shooting them. So, you know, kind of got calmed down when they opened season on them to keep the numbers down. But it's a very contentious thing up here. And, you know, this isn't good for the wolves. They're going to get gut shot and left. And it's a bad thing for the wolves, too.
Yeah, comments on that, Scott?
Well, I think that the general premise there is correct. I think that implementation of state management and oversight of wolves a few years ago, when they were taken off the endangered species list, and the ability to offer a hunting season did blunt or diffuse some of the anxiety about wolves and the general dislike of wolves by some people in some parts of Wolf Range. The fact that they're now back on the list and hunting is in limbo for a while, you know, may or may not create some of the behavior he was talking about. But I think that ultimately the best place for wolves to be is under state management. And they were, I mean, things were going along pretty well.
Pretty well.
In spite of the harvest of 154 animals last fall, with the release of the winter wolf population estimate, the minimum count grew to right around 750, maybe a few more than that during the winter, compared with the minimum count of about 675 or so for the previous year. So even with wolves being removed by hunting and for depredation control and occasionally some killed by cars and so forth, the wolf population grew again. And in the absence of those removals, because of the federal protection, it will probably grow more quickly, and that's just going to lead to more of the conflicts that got them into trouble in the first place. So we've talked before about the wisdom or lack thereof in this federal court decision, but we'll just have to see how it plays out, because as Jim said, it is very contentious. It probably always will be, but I would like to see them return to state management, and I think the state demonstrated that they could do a good job of taking care of the problems and still maintaining a healthy wolf population.
Yeah.
What will happen now, I don't know.
Jim, thanks for calling. Joe in Marquette, Michigan, your turn now. Hi, Joe.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a researcher. I'm studying lake sturgeon in northern Michigan right now.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also working with the DNR to raise some of them in their hatchery program. And I was doing my research and looking up background information. I noticed places like Black River in Sheboygan County, the Menominee River, a few places around UP, they have pretty much no, you can't catch lake sturgeon or very, very limited numbers. And we didn't find many when we sampled them. But and we also ended up looking in some Wisconsin rivers, and I saw some data from Wisconsin DNR, and I saw that it looks to me like there's a lot more lake sturgeon in Wisconsin than in Michigan. I was wondering if you knew if there's any reason for that.
Hmm. We've had a pretty good, I'll tell you one thing, we've had a very good management program of sturgeon here in the state.
Yeah, I mean, the lake sturgeon deal with this Project Sturgeon Watch in the spring, with citizen scientists getting involved in protecting the spawning runs and a lot of attention to regulation, and in the spearing situation in the, you know, in the Fox Valley and Lake Winnebago, quick quick and decisive closures when quotas are reached. I don't know what to say about that, but I think we've had a good management program, and maybe that's part of it. Maybe it's a bigger or more habitat. I don't know beyond that. I just don't know that much about sturgeon. It's a little out of my ballpark, Larry.
There is a, I would get in touch with, I'm trying to think of the name of the fellow who was in charge of the sturgeon program for the DNR. I can't think now. But I think if you go to the DNR website, you're going to be able to find that person, and Joe, and get a hold of them and talk with them. They, I'm sure, have some thoughts about it. Appreciate your call very much. And we got a nest of skunks, Rebecca says.
Hello?
Hi. What, you got some skunks to get? You need to move?
We do. We had a torrential downpour. I think she had a burrow in the woods. We live out in the country. And I watched her carry her babies one at a time up and put them under a rock pile probably about 50 feet from our garage. And they're still out there. We can smell them. And I wondered how to make them move along.
Well, if you're reasonably, the first thing you need to be sure of is that all other potential homes under your garage, under your deck, under a shed, or any other place that the young might be moved is skunk-proof, because you don't want them any closer than that rock pile. First, make sure of that, and then there are some things you could do as a kind of a do-it-yourself activity. Most mammals, and skunks in particular, are not very happy about the fragrance of naphthalene, moth flakes. And some moth flakes sprinkled.
Might do the job. Sprinkled around might do the job. Yeah. I tell you what, we'll talk some more about that, but we need to take a quick look at the news. Stay with us. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mueller, taking a look at the world of wildlife today with wildlife ecologist Scott Craven. Always great to have him come by, and certainly happy to have you listening in. Questions? Call us at 800-642-1234. You can post a question and or photo, wildlife photo, on our Facebook page. Our Facebook page title is The Larry Mueller Show. Or you can also email us at talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Scott, we were talking a little bit about getting rid of skunks, and you said, well, make sure you've skunk-proofed everything else that the skunks might want to go to, and then maybe apply some naphthalene or mothballs to the area.
Yeah, it sounded like it was a rock pile, perhaps not too large, that they had taken up residence in, and they'd moved there from somewhere else. So whatever happened to the original den, I don't know, but the female might very well move them again if she finds the smell of that naphthalene offensive enough. Then if she moves them, then they're out of sight, out of mind, maybe. To try and live trap and remove the whole family is a tricky proposition. And best done by someone who knows what they're doing, because handling, although they're a reasonably docile, clean animal, they're not something that the average person wants to try and get close to in a trap for fear of being sprayed. But again, there are folks who deal with nuisance wildlife problems like that who could help out for a fee. But I think the first thing to do is to try and convince them to relocate yet again, and some easily obtainable noxious scent like naphthalene might do the job.
Ron in Withy, Wisconsin, thank you for calling. Hi.
How you doing?
Great. Appreciate your call. What's what have you got for us?
See, I had a sighting of a black bear over about northeast of Medford a little ways. She come up on the road, and she didn't get off the road. And so I stopped and was watching her. One cub come up, and well, I knew she was waiting for her cubs. Two cubs come up, three cubs come up, and then a fourth cub come up.
Wow.
How common is that?
How common are... not very common, is it, Scott?
Not common at all. It does happen, but it is it's certainly at the upper end of the distribution. That's a lot of cubs.
And there again, that's something, Ron, you're a lucky guy to be able to see that. That's for sure. I would have been reaching for my phone to take a photo. That's what I'd have been doing. Thank you very much for calling. By the way, you can join in again, too, with your questions. Open lines get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234. Love to hear from you. We have, you know, you mentioned something earlier, Scott, taxidermy and unwanted taxidermy sometimes.
Well, this is sort of a shot in the dark in a way, Larry, but when I was up at the new sanctuary that we talked about, the Nature Center in Bailey's Harbor, we were talking about displays, and I got to talking a little bit about my work in our wildlife collection of specimens and mounted animals and so forth at the university. And we talked about how over the many years I was there, occasionally someone would call and say, gee, I have a bunch of taxidermy that was my husband's or granddad's or something, and it's still in the basement or it's in the man cave or whatever, and boy, we're just past that. We'd like to find a home for it. And it occurred to me that we talk about this kind of thing on the radio, that maybe we, you and I, or particularly me, I guess, can serve as something of a broker here. As I indicated earlier, there are a lot of really nice nature centers around the state, as well as various UW campuses and other facilities that have often said to me when I'm speaking there, boy, if you ever have any specimens of any kind, you know, anything from a mounted deer head to a fish or, you know, ducks of various species or things like that, we'd sure like to get them for the Nature Center. So taxidermy is kind of a strange thing. Some people really like it. Some people don't like it at all. And I find it very useful for educational purposes if it's done well. Really good taxidermy is a real art form. It can be expensive to have it done up front, as anybody who's had anything mounted knows.
Yeah.
But if it looks like the live animal, if it's good taxidermy, it's a beautiful piece of work, in my opinion, and has many purposes for introducing people to what these things look like, appreciating their beauty, the texture of their feathers, the color patterns, or whatever. So here's the deal. I'm willing to at least give it a shot here, that if folks have something around that they would like to see put in the hands of someone who can use it, primarily for educational or display purposes, I'm willing to try and broker that connection. Now, obviously, I don't know what that means yet. We're kind of taking a long shot here, Larry.
Yeah.
I'm disinclined to, you know, think about I'm going to be on the road constantly picking up mounted squirrels and deer and trying to take them somewhere. But I think what we could do is put people in touch with, you know, someone in their area who would like to have this stuff. And if it's a sizable collection, and over the years, well, you may remember the collection that was given to us at the university from the taxidermist over in Waukesha.
Truckloads.
In the 90s, and we filled five fairly large U-Haul trucks with stuff from that home, and I was able to provision I don't know how many museums and collections with those beautiful specimens. But it was a fantastic way to deal with that stuff as opposed to just disposing it or selling it at a yard sale kind of thing. So if people have something, especially if it's of high quality and they would like to see it serve a useful purpose, then I'll give you my email address. And people can tell me what they have and where they are and what they'd like to see done with it. And all I can promise is we'll just see how this goes. If it's, if it's a few things here and there, we can handle that. If all of a sudden there's a flood of material, we might have to get somebody else involved I don't know what to say, but I think it's worth a try. I know there are a lot of things out there. And in some cases, you know, the hunter in the family has passed away and the rest of the family just doesn't know what to do with it, but would like to see it used or go where it would be valued. So if that is the case, if you have a collection of mounted specimens that you'd like to see get into the kind of situation I just described, send me an email. It's srcraven, S-R-C-R-A-V-E-N, at wisc.edu. That's my university address, srcraven, at wisc.edu. And I'll see what I can do about this. The Ridges was pretty excited about the idea for their new nature center. I suspect other people may be as well, and we'll see what turns up.
Yeah, that's great. I think it's a wonderful idea, and I'm hoping that we get. I'm going to bet here. I'm going to make a little bet that you get some emails, more than one.
Well, and at the very least, what I'll create is kind of. I can't say this will happen overnight. It's not like if somebody gets a hold of me and says, "Well, we've got a really nice moose head that we'd like to donate." I can't, I'll be there the next morning. It's probably not going to be like that, but I can create a list of what's available and where and the person's contact information and then go back to various people I think might like to get the stuff. And if I can find somebody, if somebody calls from Green Bay and has 8 or 10 mounts, I suspect the Ridges people would be willing to pick that stuff up.
Yeah.
But there may be cases with a larger collection, and I get around the state a fair bit, still doing talks and programs and things like that, that I may be able to pick up some of it and then get it again into the hands of the people I see. So let's just see what happens. We'll report back when I'm on again the 1st of September about whether we heard from anybody. And, I need to know what you have, where you are, what you'd like to see done with it, and we'll go from there.
Yeah, and again, your email address is srcraven at wisc.edu, and we can post that up on our Facebook page as well. Cheyenne, you want to post that? She's talking to somebody on the phone, so she can't hear what I'm saying.
Yeah,
so
we'll
post it up on our Facebook page.
People have gotten pretty good about taking pictures with their smartphones or getting these on the computer and then sending them as attachments or things like that.
That'd be a cool way to do it.
A picture would be a really good way to do it, so we can evaluate what's there and the quality. And there may very well be some things you know as well as I do, Larry, that you've been into a restaurant or something and seen this moth-eaten old deer head that looks like it was harvested back in the 1700s, and that's not really the kind of thing that I'm talking about here. I'm talking about materials that are really of in good condition and top quality, or tanned furs are very useful and desirable as well. So it may not be a taxidermy mount; it may be some other specimen. It could be skulls, for example.
Yeah,
really any. Any natural history kind of thing relating to wildlife, be it skulls, furs, taxidermy, and I think we could put it to good use. We'll see what happens. It should be fun.
You mentioned photos, and I'm just looking on our Facebook page now, and Suzanne sent a really cool photo of a large snapper and some painted turtles, a couple of them right on top of the snapper's shell. And she said the snapper came right up to the edge of the water and looked directly at her. I was like, all right, what do you want?
Get these other turtles off my back, will you?
Yeah. Someone wanted you to talk about the stewardship fund, Scott.
I've been on the road a lot for the last couple of weeks, and it was my impression that was being taken up as one of the considerations in the budget bill where stewardship provisions were trying to be restored. And I think that happened. I hope it happened, but I don't know for sure. But some things like the Natural Resources Board Authority and other things that people were upset about the last time I was on have been rectified in the budget, and the budget, of course, isn't signed. I just can't say much about where stewardship ended up.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Other issues, there were It was a, what I thought was a fantastic column in Outdoor News for people who get that newspaper format. Pat Durkin's recent column talking about some of the budget proposals and from whence they came was just really well researched and done. And if people are still concerned about some of the provisions in the budget, and well, they should be, then that was a good read.
Yeah.
Beyond that, I just can't say very much. I can check it out, but I won't be on again for 2 months. But Larry, you might be able to mention that if it comes up, or yeah, maybe somebody can call and tell us what happened.
Good, good points. And Patrick Durkin is—he's such a good writer. Anyway, he may call at some point and let us know. He often listens. So David in Milwaukee up next. Hi, David.
Hello. Say the talk of bird behavior from earlier in the program inspired me to share a couple of entertaining anecdotes, one of which took place at Harrington Beach State Park.
Yeah.
A pair of kingfishers and a green heron were both feeding at the same pond. Well, it was a couple of acres, the pond, not real big. Well, apparently the kingfishers resented this heron invading its territory and its food source. So when the green heron took flight, it was maybe 100 feet off, no, say 50 feet off the ground, one of the kingfishers landed on its back and went for a little short ride. And I got the message sent and received, I guess. The other situation took place in Milwaukee County. A red-tailed hawk was hunting for worms. Yes, you heard me, hunting for worms. It was a sultry summer morning right around dawn, and the lawn at this archery range was soaked from the dew. And the hawk was sitting on the archery, on the target, the hay bale.
Yep.
And it was looking, and it would fly down and pick up a worm and feast on it. It must have been like the best, to you or me, like Sin food candy.
Well, that's a new one. I haven't heard. Thanks for calling, David. I haven't heard of red tails eating worms, but or night crawlers. But I guess why not?
Why not? If they can get a hold of them, I'd not heard of that one either. But hey, food is food, and where you can find it.
Yeah, where you can find it is, and when it's easy pickings like that.
Yep.
You're gonna. It's fun, but once again, you're not going to see something like that, like David saw, unless you're outside and
That's
looking.
Right. That's right.
And not at your phone.
That's correct.
Janie in Nakusa, it's your turn. Hi, Janie.
Hi, and thanks for taking my call. A curious question. I've always heard what we call nighthawks at night, just after dark. They seem to be always around. I would imagine they're going after the bugs in the air. What is a nighthawk? Is it a species unto itself, or is it something different?
It is a species unto itself. It's related to a whippoorwill. Looks very much like a whippoorwill. Very long. It's a fairly small bird, actually, with a small body and very narrow, long wings. They're excellent flyers. And they make a sound when they're swooping at night, gathering bugs that people... It was a very common thing for me back in New England as a kid to have lots of them flying around the town I lived in. I see them much less frequently out here. But it is a separate species. If you just Google it or look in a bird book, you'll see what they look like. And a very similar appearance, as I said, to a whippoorwill.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling.
Larry, I need to break in here for just a second.
Yeah.
As I say, I'm up at Kemp here, and the phone receiver that I'm using is beginning to beep a little bit. Just in case you lose me here in the last couple minutes, you'll know why.
Okay. Well, let's get George in Dunn County on quickly then. Hi, George.
Hi. How's it going, Larry?
Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, for the last couple of weeks, we've had a fledgling red-tailed hawk
We're out in the countryside just north of Menominee, Wisconsin.
Yep.
And it's been, like, landing on our roof, on our garage, right on the rail, on our deck, unlike, you know, what a hawk would do, because they're generally pretty shy. And I think the mother is around, but I just wondered, is it's constantly screeching, and, you know, when the mom comes by, it screeches louder. Is it in trouble? Did it get kicked out of the nest too early? I've never seen anything like this before.
It's not necessarily in trouble, and the screeching is begging for food and attention, and it'll probably be fine as long as you're willing to tolerate it in the odd places it's sitting. We have a nest on the sixth or seventh story of one of our campus buildings, and one of the two fledglings fell from the nest a week or so ago, ended up on a window ledge two floors below the nest, and has been squawking and screeching not very far from your office, Larry, there on Linden Drive, and the mother has continued to feed and provision it, both the one that was still in the nest a couple days ago and the one that was sitting on a window ledge outside someone's office two stories further down. So as soon as they're both flying well, both young will fledge and take off on their own. But I suspect the mother's still taking care of yours, and it should be fine.
Yeah, that's my question was, would it still tend to it after it got out of the nest like that?
Yes, it will, and all should end well for that bird.
Yeah, well, we think it's pretty neat. And thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, you bet. Thanks for calling.
Say, Larry, could I interject something here?
Yeah, go ahead.
I just want to say I won't be back on for 2 months here, and over the interim period, I just wanted to remind folks that some permit deadlines will come up for the DNR the 1st of August. Deadlines, for example, for the fall turkey permits and perhaps a few others. In addition, by the time early September rolls around, some fall hunting seasons for the dove season and early teal and geese will already be open on September 1st. So there are some things that are going to come up very quickly as summer begins to pass rapidly. And in addition, as I mentioned way back at the beginning, all the survey results for things like grouse and waterfowl are out and available on the DNR webpage for people interested in them.
So very good reminder, Scott. And I've got a photo from Owen on our Facebook page of four bear cubs in a tree, which is just great. And he has a video of them with the mother, and he's trying to get that loaded up on our Facebook page. It's not there yet, but he said he's going to try and get that up for us on our Facebook page to see that video. Would be a lot of fun. But the photo is absolutely great.
Well, as you said earlier, Larry, with everybody lugging a smartphone around, the possibilities of getting all sorts of terrific photos that we just never had a few years ago is really cool.
Yeah. In 20 seconds, the bat population?
There's still a lot of concern over white nose syndrome now that it's here in Wisconsin, and there's concern over this federal protection of the long-eared bat and what that may mean for some logging interests and whatnot. But, you know, beyond those two current hot-button issues, most everything else seems to be reasonably stable, and the DNR bat team is doing lots of good survey work and educational work. So.
Scott, always a pleasure. Thank you so much. We'll look forward to your next visit. Really appreciate you taking the time.
No problem. I'm going to go enjoy Kemp Station for a couple hours.
You do that. Okay. Thanks a lot. Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist extraordinaire. He's always been it's always been great to have him with us here on the Ideas Net. And he's also a good friend. He and his wife, Candy, kids, Meredith and Jeff have been good friends of mine for a long, long time. So great to have him with us. And great to have you listening. And please stay listening. Lots in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.